from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Even after 20-plus years of writing, novelist and memoirist Danny Shapiro admits that writing books doesn't get any easier. Writing is a solitary task, she says, and there's no reason to think the world is waiting for you. Shapiro's latest book, Still Writing, offers advice to fellow and aspiring authors on staying focused and inspiring creativity, and she'll join us in the studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our forum program. Danny Shapiro joins us in studio for this forum hour, the author of two memoirs, Devotion and Slow Motion. She also has published five novels, including Black and White and Family History. And she's had work appear in The New Yorker, Granta, The New York Times Book Review, The Los Angeles Times, Elle, Vogue, and Tin House. And she's a contributing editor at Travel and Leisure and has taught writing at Columbia, The New School, NYU, and Wesleyan University. Her newest book, which novelist Jennifer Egan says, quote, offers a cornucopia of wisdom, insights, and practical lessons gleaned from long experience as a celebrated writer and teacher of writing, is called Still Writing. And the subtitle is The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life. And she joins us for this second forum hour. I'm glad to have you back on forum. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Takeoffs and landings are the toughest. That's the old cliche. Is that, I mean, because you write about beginnings, middles, and endings. I'm just thinking about people who are starting to write and often say, yeah, the beginnings are the hardest and the ends are the hardest. But that's not necessarily true, is it?
I think the beginnings really, somebody once said, it's not the writing, it's the sitting down to write. I do think that the beginnings are the hardest. I think it's one of the reasons why I'm a novelist more than a short story writer or writing in the short form, because once I actually begin, then I've begun. And then there's something waiting for me every day for a long, long time that has its own velocity, its own momentum, its own universe that I can enter. But getting to that place, getting to the place of starting and sitting down and that leap of faith and feeling like there's going to be something there, I mean, that's just sheer lunacy. So it's really a hard thing to say and to really sit down and begin.
Well, it's, again, all those platitudes about staring at the blank page and not knowing. I remember Edna O'Brien in an interview we had saying, you just don't know each time if it's going to even come up, if it's going to be there for you. You assume that something will emerge, but it doesn't there's not necessarily any guarantee, obviously.
No, it's My most recent metaphor for it is like diving into a swimming pool and hoping that there'll be water.
Yet once you're in there in the swim and once you're immersed in the water and everything, there's probably nothing like it. You know, you talk about the pleasures and the perils. That pleasure of being in what they often refer to as the zone is kind of inimitable in its way, isn't it?
It's inimitable. It's once you've experienced it, one wants to be back in that place. It's flow. It's the flow state. It's when time becomes irrelevant. Time both stops and you kind of enter this this world that is the world of your creation, but it feels more real than reality does. And that, you know, Doctorow has this famous quote about writing that I love so much, which is that writing is like driving a car in the fog. Down a road, and you can only see as far as your headlights, but you can get all the way home that way. And so that feeling of it opening up and opening up just enough, just a little bit in front of you, is one of the great pleasures.
And talk about some of the other pleasures. I mean, because there are perils, as you say, as well, but the other pleasures that come from writing, especially when people go into the process of writing and they don't necessarily know if there's going to be any payoff. And it's lonely. It's the loneliness of the long distance or short distance runner, whichever the case may be.
It is, but it's also a profound engagement with the self. Joan Didion, in an essay that I love, actually, it was originally a speech called Why I Write, says, had I had even the remotest access to my own mind, I never would have become a writer. I write in order to know what it is that I think, what I feel, what I fear, what I understand. And for me, that grappling with the page on a daily basis for the past 20-plus years is how I've come to know myself. And the sense of being lost in this thicket of language, of words, and then emerging on the other side of it eventually, looking back and realizing, oh, that's what I thought. That's what I know. That's what I understand. I think for me and for many other writers, there's such a tension in trying to get things right verbally. I never feel when I'm speaking like I'm saying exactly what I want to say. But when I am alone with the page, I have all of the time in the world to try to get it right. And that's, I mean, the word essay means attempt, right? You know, it's like it's an attempt to get it right. Again and again, that grappling. And to me, that's just this enormous privilege that I get to spend my life in that engagement.
And there's a big difference, though, between getting it right with the essay and getting it right with fiction. In fact, Cynthia Ozick, an interview we did a number of years ago, said essays are always subject to change. But when you put it down in fiction, you know, and there is a real distinction to be made there. Plus, sometimes it's not just the writing in terms of finding out what you think, what you feel, what you believe. It's the rewriting, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I recently came to this idea that there's writing that's getting it down, and there's writing that's an attempt to get it right. But you can't get it right until you get it down. And as a teacher, I often think about those two different modes of teaching in a way, because, you know, I write and still writing a little bit about this. There's that famous quote Michelangelo said that when he was sculpting the David, that the David emerged out of the marble, that the David was already there and all he needed to do was remove the marble. Nakashima, the woodworker, has talked about wood in that way. But the blank page is not your wood. It's not your marble. It's just a blank page. It's absolutely nothing. And the first draft becomes your marble. The first draft becomes your wood. You don't have anything as a writer until you have that draft. And the tricky thing is, and a somewhat torturous thing for people starting out, and maybe for all of us forever, is that as you're writing that first draft, you have to trick yourself or convince yourself or believe somehow that this is really it, when in fact it's not really it. It's only just the beginning that you will then go back into and begin to understand, see the passage in the middle where it really comes to life, find the shape within it, and then essentially begin again in the revision process. There's the writing of the first draft where it's a very instinctive, almost sort of animal-like process of just sort of sniffing your way through, feeling your way through. And then there's the revision process, which is, I think, the great writers are equally adept at both, at letting themselves be able to really be free to get down a draft and then be able to be so incisive and clear and cast a really cold eye at what they've created.
Now, as Yeats said, cast a cold eye on life and death. We're talking with Dani Shapiro, and her new book is Still Writing. She'll be at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore tonight at 7:30 and a book passage in Corte Madeira at 1 o'clock tomorrow. We're talking about writers here. You're also talking about sculptors and artists in general, but when we mention names like Didion and Doctorow, or I talk about Edna O'Brien or Cynthia Ozick, it puts me to mind of the fact that so often writers don't read. I can't tell you how many young people will come to me and say, would you please read my poem or read my story and so forth, and just initially inquire, what other poets do you read or what other storytellers do you read and so forth, and there's a dearth, or sometimes there's no one that they're reading. And one thing that comes across very plainly in your book is the importance of reading to fructify, to expand, to augment what one has, whatever one may have, in the way of writing skills or writing talent.
Oh, completely. I think literature has been my teacher as much or more than any of my actual teachers and mentors.
More than Grace Paley?
Literature? All of literature might be sort of equal to Grace Paley. No, maybe even more than Grace Paley. There's a wonderful piece of wisdom that the poet Jane Kenyon offered. There's a list of instructions that I came upon that she gives to writers starting out, and one of them is keep good sentences in your ears. If I start my day just dipping into beautiful prose, my day, my writing day, and my day in general will go better than if I start my day, checking the internet for anything, for, you know, shopping for boots or looking myself up or any of the awful things that I do, you know, first thing in the morning when I'm kind of getting in my own way, as I would put it.
How much time do you spend shopping for boots?
It's a great distraction, Michael.
So, I mean, all those things can invade your consciousness, and writing is a discipline, and you make that clear in your book, that you have to do. I mean, people will get up and do exercise every day, or they'll do meditation or something, and writing is like that. You have to, I remember Michael Chabon saying, to sit your carcass down and just get the process underway.
Yeah, I think there's a misapprehension that writers sit down when we're inspired, and it's only in the state of inspiration that we are able to produce anything. If I waited for inspiration, I mean, Still Writing is my eighth book. If I'd waited for inspiration, I might have like one chapbook to my name.
Was it Mencken who said it's 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration? Mm. Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. So, but also not letting those other things divert you or get in the way. I mean, there are so many obstacles, and people will constantly use excuses of every kind not to stay at the discipline.
Well, there's tremendous resistance. The longest walk of my day every morning is from the coffee maker in my kitchen to my chair in my office and when I'm actually beginning to work. So many things can get in my way I've never counted how many steps it actually takes, but let's say it's 50 steps from my coffee maker to up the stairs to my office. So many things, I'm completely alone in my house, can get in my way in that long journey to getting work done. I can be walking past my living room and look into my living room and think, oh, you know, I think I'm going to redo the curtains. That would be sort of a big example and maybe an overstatement. But one of the greatest challenges, and this is something that faces every writer I know, is that once I am sitting at my desk, I've actually gotten my carcass in the chair. With one click, I can be somewhere else. And, you know, the internet is crack for writers. It just is. Because it's so reflexive before you're even thinking of what you're doing. And you can be doing it in the name of research. I wrote an essay about this actually where I describe, I go through the entire process. I was working on a piece of fiction and I had two characters walking up the stairs. And on the landing of the staircase, as I imagined it, there was a bureau, a chest of drawers. And I really needed to know more about that chest of drawers, I decided right in that moment. So I went on Google, and the next thing I knew, I was on the website of an antique store in Paris looking at Biedermeier antique chests of drawers. And then that reminded me that I hadn't paid my son's camp tuition yet because I was thinking that I couldn't afford a Biedermeier chest of drawers. So I clicked over to the camp website, and then they require that you download a photograph of your kid to be able to complete the forms. So then I'm in my photo album. And the next thing I know, all in the name of research, I have moved so far away from, wait a minute, my characters were walking up the stairs. And once you move that far away, you've kind of broken the world. You know, you've taken yourself out of the world that you've created.
Well, you talk about wanting to know about something like that requires research in the example you just mentioned, but a lot of your writing is personal. I mean, it seems to me that often writers, and you do this a good deal in your memoirs particularly, go inward to find out, as you said, what you really think and so forth. But then there are writers who are constantly trying to find out what's behind different kinds of objects, you know, create a setting, all the furniture that might be there, how does this person live, details about nature and so forth and so on, other people besides oneself and so forth. And a lot of finding out where, if there's a muse in you, is finding out whether it's the interior or the exterior or how to bring those two together, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think we choose. I don't think we choose our subject matter so much as writers. I think our subject matter chooses us. Every piece of work that I've ever embarked on has announced itself to me as what it was.
Even this book, you said you heeded a call. You were writing a blog, right?
Well, yeah, I was still writing. It actually was a little bit of a different experience because it began as a blog. My publisher had urged me to start blogging, and I couldn't imagine what I would blog about that wouldn't make me want to shoot myself. And I didn't think the world was going to care what I had for breakfast. And I was casting about for an idea, and it became very clear to me that the creative process, not just writing, but just the what it takes to sit down in a solitary way and make something out of nothing, that felt like a well that I could keep on dipping into. And so I started blogging, and this funny thing happened, which is I started getting these notes from people, and they were writers who I admired. They were peers of mine. They were writers just starting out. And every single note contained within it, almost eerily so, the same exact sentence. And the sentence was, they were thanking me, and the sentence was, this is what I needed today. This is what I needed today, again and again and again. And I thought, I guess I'm doing something that people need to read. And I found myself very interested in just continuing to delve into these little aspects of what makes the creative process, what makes it work, what makes it possible, what makes us able to overcome resistance, what makes us able to find the patience, the ability to endure. And then finally people started writing to me and saying, when's the book coming out? And I wasn't writing a book, and I hadn't done the blog thinking I was going to write a book. So still writing is different in the sense that Joan Didion describes finding or recognizing her subject matter as sort of something having a shimmer around the edges of it. This book didn't come from the shimmer. This book came from finally a recognition on my part that people wanted this book. Like this was something that that maybe I needed to write because there was a desire for it, as opposed to I needed to write because it was coming out of that that internal shimmering place.
But even in this book, you get into some of your personal life and personal narration, and you've gone pretty deep in memoirs that you've written, which I've read. And the fact of the matter is that those present some of the perils. I think, weren't they doing a story on NPR about one of your memoirs, and your son was with you, and
yes,
you had to kind of want to cover his ears and stuff because this was, out of a past that you have moved beyond, to put it mildly.
Yes.
So there are all those kinds of perils.
Yes. Well, I mean, that was really a meta moment, that moment, because that was a piece of my first memoir, Slow Motion, that I had read on This American Life 20 years ago, and they were rebroadcasting it, and it was a time, when our son was born, somebody said to my husband, one of his friends said, if he ever asks you if you've done drugs, lie. And that was the piece of parental advice. And if you've written a memoir about your complicated early 20s,
honest mistakes in life,
as I have, yeah. You don't get to lie. It's all sort of out there, and I wasn't ready for him to hear about that, to read about that, and yet that's a book. And the interesting thing to me is that there's the mother, and then there's the writer, and the mother in me might not have written that book after my son was born. The writer in me is very glad that I did write the book and is very glad that the book exists, even though it makes my life a little complicated. But that, in still writing, those memoir pieces were very much for me about what was formative for me as a writer. That was the specific place that my mandate to myself of what I wanted to enter at every one of those memoir places. Being an only child, being raised in an Orthodox Jewish family, the Sabbath, just having a day, 24 hours every week in which I couldn't do anything, couldn't ride my bike, couldn't do homework, couldn't play the piano, gave me a lot of time to think, to dream, to develop a very active imagination. Did I know that that was turning me into a writer? No, I was just bored. I was just a bored kid. But when I look back on it now, there's a lot that I understand about what built me as a writer.
Well, your narrative, if I can put it as such, is you were kind of, as a young adult, really sort of a lost soul in many ways in trying to find yourself. And part of what saved you, and you do hear people say from time to time that they are saved by writing, or they're saved by acting, or they're saved by finding, you know, painting and something that really nourishes their souls. That's certainly the case with you.
Yes. I think of writing memoir as an act of transforming chaos into story, or transforming chaos into hopefully art. It is such, I mean, writing, becoming a writer, absolutely, it saved my life. I don't think it's too dramatic a statement for me to make. And it grew me. It everything, you know, my maturation. And, you know, when readers read my two memoirs back to back, which has been happening a lot lately, they read Slow Motion, which is the story of this really lost soul, as you put it, this very rebellious and a young woman who really didn't know herself. And then they read Devotion, which is a memoir about a spiritual journey of a, you know, midlife wife and mother living in rural Connecticut and doing yoga and meditating and trying to find her teachers and trying to talk to her young son about what she believes and wrestling with the whole idea of God. And readers look at those two books side by side and think, how? You know, how did that girl become this woman? And to me, actually, that's I've grown to really embrace and love being able to talk about, like, yes, that girl could become this woman. Why not? Lives can contain many chapters and many stories.
But that girl had to go through personal tragedy, too. Parents in a terrible car crash and really realizing to a great extent as a result of that car crash who she really is.
But those are moments that can bury us or that we can rise out of and make something out of. And for me...
But you're saying your story is a story of hope, I think.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear that.
And I would agree. And yet one of the perils of writing, of course, is that people can misinterpret your story or they can judge it in ways that don't necessarily conform to the message that you want to impart. And in fact, in some cases, you can find yourself wanting to write about hope and finding that you're writing about hopelessness.
Well, I think people also read memoir differently and they tend to review a life rather than review the story that's on the page.
How did you keep those moments, though, from burying you?
I think when my father died, I was 23, and he died in a car accident. And when he died, I think he died very disappointed in me, worried about me. Maybe not disappointed, but he hadn't given up hope, but he was worried about me. And it was and continues to be the greatest sadness of my life that he, that those were his last impressions of me.
Hold that thought, because we're coming up on a break, and the break doesn't wait for anyone, least of all me. I want to give out a number, too. If people want to join us, they can do that now with Dani Shapiro, talking about writing and talking about her life and work. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so feel free to join us. Again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Dani Shapiro. Her new book is Still Writing, and she's also the author of Black and White, Slow Motion, and Devotion, and will be appearing at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore tonight at 7:30 and at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Even after 20-plus years of writing, she, a novelist, memoirist, essayist, admits that writing books doesn't get any easier, and writing is a solitary task, she says, and I'm quoting now, there's no reason to think the world is waiting for you. Her latest book, Still Writing, offers advice to fellow writers on staying focused and inspiring their own creativity, and it's actually, I think, for fledgling writers as well, and you were saying before we went to the break, just talking again about the process for you and what it has meant for you. Let me just pick up that thread.
Yeah, no, I think we were talking about the impetus or the motivation for me after my father died. I think had my parents, the tragedy of my personal tragedy of my parents' accident not happened, I don't know that I would have become a writer. I don't know what would have happened to me. But I think from that moment forward, the feeling that I had was that this senseless, random thing had happened. And there was so much senselessness and so much randomness. And I needed to try to make it mean something. I needed to try to shape it in some way into something that might touch others, something that might connect with others. And that feeling from that moment forward of really almost I internalized my father as my compass, as my moral compass. And for a long time, because I didn't really have one yet of my own. I have one now, but at 23, I didn't. And so whenever I was at some fork in the road, I would ask myself, you know, what would my father want me to do here? And that continued to sort of lead me in this direction of moving in a positive way. But my very first novel, which I don't talk about and which no one should read, was autobiographical, very autobiographical first novel, and it came out of a very young and, you know, sort of literarily immature, but need to write about my parents' car accident. I wrote an entire novel so that I could write the last 75 pages of this young protagonist's parents' car accident. One of the reasons why it's not a very good novel is that the car accident didn't belong in the novel. It probably would have been a pretty good novel if I hadn't written the car accident, but I was writing towards it because I had to try to kind of memorialize it, and I had to try to make sense of it. It took another 10 years before I really wrote about it in slow motion at a point where I had enough distance and perspective. And someone once said to me about memoir that the act of writing memoir is being able to be ironic about your own life. I couldn't write about any of all of that Sturm und Drang, everything that I was still so completely alive and feeling inside of me while I was still totally inside of it.
That was certainly true for writing about, well, the affair with the married man that you had and the rather extraordinary circumstances that led to that and that followed as a result of that. I mean, again, you need distance from these kinds of things, don't you? You need to sort of sort them through and process them.
Well, when I was writing Slow Motion, I kept thinking of myself as that girl. I was far enough away from it. I was in my early 30s writing about my early 20s. And I think in memoir that where the writer tells the story from, the relationship between the writer and the story in time, is in part the story. If I had written Slow Motion now, in midlife, it would be a completely different book than the book that I wrote in my early 30s. It's one of the complexities of memoir, and it's why in the wake of what I've called like the pathological memoir, you know, writers just inventing stuff and calling it memoir. In the wake of all that, publishers are often asking writers to fact check, to have, you know, have memoirs go through the fact checking process. And it makes me laugh because you can fact check certain facts, but you can't fact check memory.
Well, I remember, I think it was Jerzy Kosinski who said memory has to account for feelings, and as feelings change, memories change, and they go through a different editing process. It's like, you know, I'll tell students that if you read Hamlet when you're 18, it's a very different play than when you read it if you're in your 30s. It's simply not the same play. But you talk about your father's voice as being sort of the moral compass for you. How does that differ from what you call the inner critic, or maybe even what Hemingway calls, you know, the BS factor that sorts through and says, look, this is not being honest, or this is not being, or this is not going to ignite people, or this is, you know, all that sorting that really has to be done with, especially your own material.
I have a chapter in Still Writing called Inner Censor, where I write about the whole question of that voice that's in a writer's head, you know, when we sit down to write, and sorting through, you know, is that voice actually helping you or hurting you? every piece of work that I've begun in the last 5, 6, 7 years has begun with this feeling of utter futility. Here goes nothing. This time it's not going to work out. This time I'm in over my head. I don't have the background to write this particular book review. Who do I think I am to write about spiritual life? This time, you know, all evidence aside, I'm not going to be able to do it. And that's my toxic inner censor.
This happens even after you've become an accomplished and successful writer.
Oh, I don't think it ever goes away. And I think perhaps it shouldn't go away. I think that a confident writer is in trouble. I think confidence is useless for the writer. And people mistake or they confuse confidence with courage. Courage is essential. Courage means being scared and moving through your fear anyway. Hearing all those voices in your head saying you can't do it, who do you think you are, so-and-so did it better, and saying thank you very much, I hear those voices, but I'm going to do it anyway. But confidence, a confident writer, I think, doesn't have the feeling of needing to struggle to get it right, to communicate, and to find, you know, what Emerson called the thread of the universal. A confident writer thinks what I have to say simply is universal, and that results in dead, bloated, and narcissistic prose, I think.
Well, again, let me invite those of you listening to join us. If you're looking for some advice on writing, this is a good time to join the conversation here with any questions you might have. But also, those of you who write, I put out really a question: What are the pleasures of writing, and what are the perils of writing from your experience? And this may just involve writing, you know, for your employment, or having to write that particular letter that you felt needed to be written for to somebody personal. But just those of you particularly who are interested in writing on any level, think about the pleasures it gives you and think about the dangers or the perils that it gives you, and let's hear from you. Let me give out the toll-free number, and you can join our conversation. We do welcome your involvement. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Here's a listener who writes, do you have any advice for the significant other of a writer? My fiancé is working on his first novel, and I want to support his dream. How do I do that without getting in the way or pushing too hard? And we should mention that Danny's husband is also an artist, writer, and filmmaker. You support each other, I presume.
We do. You know, it's funny. We've been married 16 years, and early in our relationship, people would make this assumption that we would be competitive with each other because we're both we both write, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. I think there are relationships like that. I can't imagine being in one, and I can't imagine the horror of being in one. There's enough competition out there without having it be like the person you go to sleep with every night. My husband, Michael, is a filmmaker. He was a journalist for many years. He was a foreign correspondent before he became a filmmaker. And so we do different kinds of work. But in terms of supporting one another, it depends on what the person needs. People need different things. I read to Michael every day when I'm in the middle of working on a book because I know he has my back. I know that he's going to be tougher on me than anybody, but at the same time, he completely wants my work to be the best it possibly can be, and he's my first reader. He doesn't show me anything until it's completely, totally finished to the best of his ability, and at that point, I have to kind of wrestle it from him before it goes out the door to anybody else. So those are very different processes. He needs to be just kind of in his messy creative state for a really long time until he finds his way, and I'm much more methodical, you know, as I go.
But you do depend on each other to some great degree, and I think that's the important message for that call, that emailer. There's also brings up another point. I'm going to go to your calls and more of your emails in just a moment, but you trust certain people to read your work, whether it's draft or in process and so forth, and they're often people who you trust for good reasons. I mean, they're good readers, they're thoughtful and so forth, and you know they're not necessarily going to be kind to you. They're also going to be honest with you. But for example, I recently completed a draft of a book. I gave it to two people, and one reader said, "I really liked the scholarly material, but the personal writing that you did here really just didn't grab me that much." And the next reader said the exact opposite: "I really liked the personal material, but the scholarly material was too dry." So you really have to sort through that, and sometimes it can just confuse you to a greater degree.
It's true. It's true. I write a bit and still writing about choosing your readers. And even when you're discerning as you are and chose your readers very carefully, there is still ultimately, I think, a very deep instinctive place that you have to get to about what feels right and what it is that you want to do. Did you set out to write a scholarly book, or did you set out to write a personal book, or is this a hybrid? And the whole idea of not being able to please all the people all of the time, but that's another peril. that's a peril, but also in terms of choosing readers, I see a lot of writers want readers who are really only going to say, you know, "You're awesome, you rock, this is great, you should be out there, and you should self-publish this, or this should be on. I once had a friend who gave me a very well-published writer who gave me an 800-page draft of something of his to read, and I read it very carefully, and we met for dinner, and I got about 5 minutes into talking to him about some issues that I had with it, and I have a pretty good bedside manner, and I was being kind, but there were a couple of things that I thought he needed to really think about. And all of a sudden I realized, oh, he had only wanted me to praise him. And I had read 800 pages and taken all that time for nothing. And that's not – your best readers are able to enter the work on the work's terms, you know, and not only on their terms. It's not about what they would like the work to be like if they were writing it, but rather what the work wants to be.
Our guest again is Dani Shapiro. And by the way, a number of listeners want to know how to spell your name. It's just D-A-N-I. And her new book is Still Writing. Darshana writes, "So often writers don't read. So true. My friends tell me they too want to write a blog like me, but they don't read. I say if you simply want to be opinionated and want to share your opinions, but you don't read, then you simply can't write anything of any interest to anyone." Mm. So let me bring in our callers. And by the way, you're going to be on Oprah. This is sort of many writers' dreams, to put it mildly.
I am this Sunday on Oprah's wonderful, wonderful show, Super Soul Sunday, at 11 a.m. Oprah and I spent an hour together talking about my life and my work, and it was thrilling, absolutely
thrilling. Did you come away admiring and liking her?
Very much so. I've never had the experience of, you know, TV is scary, and Oprah's an icon, and
I saw a little clip, by the way. You looked pretty glam.
I had a lot of makeup on, yeah. But I was really comfortable. And I think that her particular genius is that she wants to have an experience with her guest. That's who she chooses to come on the show, is someone that she just wants to have an experience with. And she is genuinely, genuinely curious. So the whole conversation was, I forgot that there were cameras. And that's a really hard thing to do when there are that many cameras.
And this was a discussion about sort of your spiritual quest. The devotion book was what really was a catalyst.
Yeah, that was central to it, was the whole question of my son when he was young asking me what it was that I believed and embarking on this journey.
Let's go to your calls. We go to Washington, D.C. Stephanie joining us. Good morning, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks. I have a question for Dani. I'm wondering, how do you hold compassion for yourself on those days that you don't make it from the kitchen to the office? And do you salvage the day later, or do you give up until the next morning and start anew?
That's a really wonderful question, and I love the phrase salvage compassion. I have some tricks up my sleeve that involve with being able to begin again. During the course of a day, it can be very hard. I mean, my feeling mostly when I really get in my own way at the beginning of a day is, if this day in its fullness, in its, you know, in the gift of this day, ends with my having accomplished nothing but getting in my own way, I'm really not going to like myself very much tonight. So how can I begin again? And for me, I have a yoga practice and I work at home. And one of the things that I will do when I reach that point is I'll unroll my mat. It's just if I do that, it will work. At the end of my yoga practice, my mind will once again be in that really lovely state that it's in when we first wake up in the morning, and it's kind of ironed clean and there's a lot of room and there all the noise of the day, all the detritus, all the to-do lists, all the anxiety hasn't set in yet. So it's really about that feeling of trying to begin again. But
is this just regular hatha yoga, or do you use something a little more exotic than that?
I have a vinyasa-based Anusara practice that I kind of developed myself over the years after doing a lot of yoga classes, because I live in the middle of nowhere where there's not a lot of yoga available, or if there is, I have to drive an hour for it, and then that becomes my day. And then that's another form of procrastination. That's yoga as procrastination.
Thank you for that question, Stephanie. Good to hear from you, and we'll hear next from Krista. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say, first of all, that I'm a huge fan of Danny Shapiro's. I've been a writer since I was 25, and I'm twice that age now. And I've had three books published, but I do find that with every book, I feel like I don't know how to write a book. I don't know what I'm doing. And one of the things that helps me, and it's funny because I also have a yoga mat that I roll out when I get stuck, and I dip into people like James Salter and Michael Ondaatje and Jane Ann Phillips and Amy Hempel, and they all kind of sometimes, they can really show me the way. But what I wanted to talk about was the way that even though right now, although I used to make a really excellent living at writing, and I was published by all, you know, big houses, now it's the publicity is all up to you, and you have to make it happen, and I'm not so good at that part, so right now I'm supplementing my income by pet sitting and stuff, but sometimes people ask me, well, why are you doing it? I mean, you don't even know if this book's going to get picked up or whatever, and I think how empty my life would be if I didn't have the writing. If it's like this subterranean river that runs through my life and that I'm always grabbing details for and dipping down under and pulling them back up and finding the truth as I try to write about it. And without that, I would be just an eighth of myself.
As long as you can put food on the table with dog walking, I think you're okay.
Well, and actually, like,
dog... And food stamps.
dog sitting seems like a really wonderful sideline for a writer, because they're good company, and they're not taking up a whole lot of your bandwidth in terms of the stuff that you're thinking about and observing. But I love what you said, and I actually really I hear you completely about, you know, there's a chapter in Still Writing about risk. I think it's called Risk, and a realization that I had in the last couple of years. I mean, my husband just directed and his first feature film based on his own script, and it's an indie script. He raised the money for it himself, and you know, and I'm a novelist and a memoirist, and you know, we have a kid and a house and dogs and you know, mouths to feed and all of that, and it was a pretty scary couple of years, honestly, and I had this thought at a certain point, which is that risk actually really means risk. Risk means risking without a safety net. And if you are an artist, you don't really have much choice in the matter. If I'm not writing, and I actually say this in Still Writing, if I'm not writing, I'm not well. And I think if you're a writer, it's something that you have to do. Whether I gave a reading the other night at a bookstore in Arizona, and I usually ask how many writers there are in the audience, and this time I said, how many of you write? And all of the hands went up when I asked how many of you write. And I realized that the calling of oneself a writer, the giving permission in the face of friends saying, well, why are you bothering? How do you know? We never know. We never know. Every single book I begin, I don't know how to write that book. You're at the bottom of a mountain, and it's a new mountain. It's like you've climbed Kilimanjaro, and now you're looking at Everest, and you haven't climbed Everest before. Or you might be looking at a hill. You haven't climbed that hill before. It's every single book begins, I think, with the writer in a state of kind of palms open, eyes open, looking up and just, you know, at the mountain and saying, I don't know.
And not necessarily knowing if even once the writing starts, if it will be received well, if it will be recognized, if there will be any royalty checks or publication and so forth. I mean, you're really moving into the dark like that. But I was struck by Krista's call in the sense that I remember Jim Lehrer, whose novels I was never that crazy about, but nevertheless, who once compared, he wrote novels his whole career as a newsman, and he said it was like a small fever that he just had with him all the time and he had to kind of tend to.
I love that. Small fever, yeah.
Let me get another call on here. And that's Joan from Palo Alto. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for this wonderful conversation. I wanted to ask Danny how you live with the fact that no piece of art is really ever completed.
These are just such great questions or thoughts. I had a mentor in graduate school at Sarah Lawrence. He was a wonderful novelist and a wonderful man named Jerome Bidanis. And Jerry used to say, all novels are failures. And that was enormously comforting to me. And maybe only a writer would find a statement like all novels are failures to be comforting. But I do, because there's always a point at which a book ends. And you've taken it as far as you possibly can, and you've reached that point of draft after draft after draft, and then finally being in that state of taking a comma out and putting it back in, that like sort of being the very end of like you know you're done when you're at the level of one comma and what to do about it. But at the same time, if you put it in a drawer and you came back to it 5 years from now, you could make it better.
Listen, Faulkner wrote the appendix to The Sound of the Fury, 16 years later? He felt he didn't get it right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and Ray Carver used to famously, when he would give readings, hold a red pencil in his hand when he was reading from his published work.
It was bad enough that Gordon Lish put the red pencil in it, too. But let me thank the caller. The book is still Writing the Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life, and the author is Danny Shapiro, who is here with us. Here's a listener who writes, last night I was going over school goals with my reticent fourth grader, and to my amazement, he popped out, cannonball to start, swim to shore to finish. I posted those words above my desk. Another listener writes, I want to know, what is your message to another person who may have talent and life experience similar to yours but is not finding herself, and this is Farhana, excuse me, and realizing that her relief or the cure for her sorrow and struggle is to write?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So
I think the question is, what do you do if you don't have that movement forward in terms of you feel you have the experience, you feel you have, you know.
And you have the burning desire to write?
I think that's what I'm reading it as saying, yeah. That would cure you and yet you can't find the cure from the medicine cabinet or something.
Well, and I think it's dangerous to think of it as a cure. I don't think it's a cure. In a way, it's an ongoing dialogue. It's an ongoing dialogue with the page, with the self, with the world, to be exploring we use this literary word theme a lot. Theme is just a fancy word for what our obsessions are, and so the idea of needing to get to that on the page, and the another misapprehension that in and of itself is cathartic. That's a word I have a lot of trouble with. This idea of writing as cure, writing as catharsis. I think all we can ask of writing is that it allows us the opportunity to hold up a mirror to ourselves, to the world around us. Sometimes it's a mirror, sometimes it's a telescope, sometimes it's a magnifying glass. But to use words as, you know, our pickaxe, use words as our tool to be able to, find that thread of what it is that we know, what we believe, what we understand. That itself, I think, is the journey of the writer.
Pickaxe makes me think of Anne Sexton, who actually, I think, borrowed those words from Kafka about an axe for the ice within. And, also thinking about this idea of a cure or catharsis. When you write memoir sometime, and I've written memoir, so I guess I can speak with mild authority here. There's a psychoanalyst, a British psychoanalyst named Winnicott, who says that the purpose of psychoanalysis is to make ghosts into ancestors. And I always liked that idea for memoirs, because sometimes that's exactly what you're doing, even if you don't realize it on a conscious level.
I have become closer to both of my parents, who are both gone, through the process of writing about them. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker years ago about my father's second marriage. My mother was my father's third wife. And I wrote a piece about his second marriage, which was something I knew nothing about when I began. It was this family secret. It was something, it was a woman I didn't even know had existed until I was 17. And because I was writing it for The New Yorker and it was a personal history piece, it had to be fact-checked. I dove back into this world of my father as a young man, the same age as I was writing it. And I got to know him. I got to know a time in his life that explained a lot about the man that I knew. You know, when people that we love die, our relationship with them doesn't end. And I think in writing about both of my parents, it's allowed me to continue the relationship and to continue the dialogue, sometimes uncomfortably. You know, I had a very difficult relationship with my mother, and it's not always comfortable when I write about her. And also, just for all of you out there who are thinking that, oh, do we have to...
The music's coming up. it's telling us we have to conclude, unfortunately, because we could go on and on. In fact, I was reminded of a line of my idol, Sal Bellows, who said, "The dead continue to visit us, whether we like it or not." Thank you so much for being with us. Dani Shapiro's book is Still Writing, and again, she'll be at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore tonight at 7:30, Book Passage, Corte Madeira, at 1 tomorrow. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.